You can support this podcast at patreon.com/partnersincrimemedia.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and this is Crime Writers On, the podcast about other podcasts and also about journalism, pop culture, true crime, and this week, a television expose revolving around my favorite cult. So should you watch Scientology The Aftermath? Well, we will talk about this A&E series featuring the Queen of Queens, Leah Remini, and then let you know whether or not we think it's worth your time. Joining me right now is the host of These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order podcast, my true crime co-author and real life husband, and 100% definitely for real suppressive person, Kevin Flynn. Good evening, Kevin.
Hello, Rebecca. I'm so excited to be here.
Also joining us is journalist, true crime author, former defense investigator, licensed PI, certified cat lady, and newly minted health and fitness expert, Laura Bricker. Good evening, Laura.
Good evening. I like that I have a new thing added to my title. I've taken some slack. I just wrote about how I went on a fitness challenge and I only lost 3 pounds. The part I didn't include, if I had given up the wine, I probably would have lost the 10 pounds.
Yeah, probably.
Just wasn't possible.
Would it have been worth it, though? That's the bigger question,
no.
Right?
But congratulations on your 3 pounds.
Yeah, 3 pounds, which I put all back on since Christmas, so rock on.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure I found him because you lost him. Also joining us, we have a special guest panelist this week because Toby Ball is on vacation. Joining us, we are thrilled to have her, is the very prolific crime reporter and online journalist, Amelia McDonald Perry. Amelia, welcome to Crime Writers On.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yay.
Now, Amelia, you have like a really impressive resume for our show anyway, compared to
the four of us.
First of all, we connected to you in Brooklyn, New York, where you live. So we're going to hear the atmospheric sounds of the mean streets of New York behind you, which is going to be very exciting for us.
Screaming, sirens. Yeah.
Street fights. Mm-hmm. But you are the founder and former editor-in-chief of thefrisky.com. I know, a blog that I read a lot. And lately you've been covering tons of crime and pop culture stuff for Rolling Stone magazine. And I think the way our listeners might know you best is you were that sassy reporter at the Adnan Syed PCR hearing.
Yes, I was the one making the face at Thero. Yeah, that was me. That was moi. And I will be happy to do that anytime I see him, if I am so lucky. But yes, that was me. But yeah, I used to be, I ran a women's website for, 8.5 years. And then I need to stop having opinions on absolutely everything every day. And so I quit and kind of decided to focus on what has become kind of like my real sort of passion interest, which is, crime and criminal justice issues and weird investigatory stuff, going down basically like wormholes. And getting to write about things that I'm obsessed with. So that's what I've been doing for like the last year, and it's awesome.
And who doesn't love a good wormhole?
I mean, I love a good wormhole.
I love a great vortex myself.
Yeah.
Now, you actually, during that Adnan Syed PCR hearing, a lot of people were tweeting about you because didn't you like have a little bit of a back and forth with Thero, maybe like on the courthouse steps or something? Didn't you ask him a question?
Yeah. Well, after the hearing was over, the Attorney General, had like a sort of a little bit of a press conference out front of the courthouse just to sort of like, discuss how we felt like the hearing went. And I was like, well, I got to see this, because after sitting and watching the hearing the whole time, I mean, to me, it was like a slam dunk that Justin Brown completely like killed that hearing. And I felt like the AG's office and Thero, like, they only had 2 witnesses. It was like more about Thero getting up in court and sort of just like performing than it was about him actually presenting anything. So I was eager to see how he was going to sort of sell, because he's such a salesman. And sure enough, he was just selling it like he had won that hearing. Like it was obvious like that he had held his own and that the judge wasn't going to overturn anything and that they're confident in their conviction and blah, 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 blah. And I just sort of like stared at him. And I was like, are you serious, dude? Were we at the same hearing? Are you sure? So yeah, that was what prompted the face. I just like couldn't believe what I was hearing. It's very strange. It's sort of like Trump-like, the way you watch somebody sort of like, try and tell you that it's raining, but it's actually like a blue, sunny, wonderful day outside. And yeah, it was like that. Like, you just can't work with somebody like that. I was like, I had to go. And I walked away and I cried at like the 7-Eleven because I just couldn't handle it.
Oh my God.
It was so emotional. Oh, I was so angry.
I also follow you on social media. So I know you also have some thoughts about something that we've talked about a lot in our show. Sarah Koenig's not acknowledging some of the advancements that have been made in the Adnan Syed case post her reporting on Serial and her just not talking about that at all. And right. What do you think about that?
It bothers me because I actually, if it was a simple matter of her not wanting to acknowledge it, I mean, that would bother me too. But I think what I find sort of upsetting about it is that I actually genuinely believe that she hasn't actually listened to Undisclosed for, maybe she has by now, but I know that at the hearing, because I talked to her about it, I said, well, have you listened to Undisclosed yet? And she just kind of was like, no. And to me, I don't know, I find that strange. As somebody who I feel like we're similar in a way, like we both, you get really passionate about a certain subject, story that you're working on. And I can't imagine investing as much time as she did in Adnan's case and then not kind of staying up to date in some way. Not to say that, she's a very busy woman. I know that she was working on season 2 and then I think she's working on season 3 now. But I just thought it was bizarre that once she was sort of done with her part of the case, she was like disconnected from it, which, wouldn't have been a big deal except for the fact that she was covering the hearing by podcasting from there. And I just sort of, there were so many things that she clearly was not aware of, like updates that had happened in the case that I feel like were essential for her to know in order to for her to podcast about the hearing and present where the case was at that point accurately. And so that I found really, frankly, kind of like egregious. And it also just felt snobby as hell to me. So, and I don't like that. So that was, I was done with her at that point.
You're dead to me.
Why would you say egregious?
I don't know, because I just think that she is, especially at that point, sort of the source of information for people about that case. And
she's the paper of record.
Yeah.
And like, I think that at this point, Undisclosed has built up a big enough following and Robbie has written her book. And therefore, a lot of people have sort of realized that you want to know what's going on with the Adnan Syed case. You don't go to Sarah Koenig. But at that point, I think that people still did. And so for her to sort of podcast about the hearing without updating herself on the case, I thought was unfair to him. Because the fact of the matter is that public opinion does have an impact on how these cases go. I mean, it's attention. It draws in the media. And I think that we have a responsibility if you're going to be somebody who, like, makes yourself the sort of expert on something to actually maintain your expertise if you're going to kind of continue to, contribute to that story. That's what kind of bothered me.
I hear what you're saying. And I think that, if anything bothered me about it, it was only that she doesn't acknowledge that there's other information out there in any way. She doesn't She doesn't say, some people say that this cell phone evidence doesn't add up at all. Some other, it's almost as if it doesn't exist at all. Even if she had kept up on it but didn't agree with it or thought it was BS or whatever, the fact that she's operating and broadcasting as if it doesn't exist is the thing that kind of bothers me. Kevin, I know that you have an opinion on this, right?
Well, yeah. And again, I think I've said this earlier that I don't think that Sarah owes us anything more on the Adnan Syed case.
Oh, I agree.
But she did make those podcasts
from
the hearing.
Yeah, which were kind of weird.
They were bad.
Yeah. And we now know that she was seeking audio tape from the PCR. So I'm not quite certain what was going through her mind as far as, what ultimately she wanted to get out of that professionally. Were they going to do, pardon the term, an addendum to season 1 or what? So at the time, I kind of thought that she was done with it and her part of telling the story is over. So I'm not certain why she went to the PCR now, other than I'm thinking that maybe she's like kind of poking around and saying, is there something here for us to report on?
I'll give you one big reason she went back to the PCR hearing. MailChimp and Audible.com.
Oh,
No, I'm not kidding. This is, you can't overlook the fact. No, I'm not kidding. You can't overlook the fact that anything Serial related that team does has a big revenue impact on that company. It does. And it's,
yeah, I'm sure that there were people who were like, above who were sort of like, hey, this hearing's going on, maybe you should go and cover it. And it's possible she was like, listen, I'm really busy, do I have to? And they were like, yes. And she maybe had to go, or not had to, but was like strongly encouraged to kind of podcast because they knew it would get a lot of downloads.
Right. I mean, now, Amelia, you have been writing about the series we're going to be talking about the second half of our show, Scientology, The Aftermath. You know, your first story could have been a one-off, you know, column, and then Rolling Stone could have decided, you know what, you should follow this episode by episode, because that story got a lot of views, and we were able to link to our other reporting about Scientology, and they brought it. So it was sort of like it was worth it for them to have you continue. I don't think there's anything wrong with there being a revenue upside, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was one of the compelling reasons she went to that hearing and did those little podcast episodes from the closet.
But again, if I'm, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, Amelia. I mean, there's a lot of different podcasts that have been looking at different aspects post Serial. And I think that if I were Sarah and I decided I was going to do something, I would stick to what does Adnan's team say? What does Adnan say? Even Rabia, although you know, she's super close to Adnan and is, you know, kind of part of the legal team, that's not who's speaking in court.
Right. There was right? no Justin Brown right. so, in those podcasts.
And those
episodes.
Right. So I think she's, I got to hear this from Justin Brown.
Right.
In order to get a sense of where the case is. And not that, you know, that maybe this is the person who did it and this is the evidence that doesn't fit. And not saying none of that is correct or incorrect, but I think that, you know, I would want to just kind of hear it myself. Now, it might be beneficial to know that, well, somebody is saying that this is this, and that's going to be part of the argument.
Right, right. Well, it was interesting, and I really enjoyed following your coverage. That was sort of when I became aware of you and your writing, and then I realized that you were that frisky lady.
It was honestly kind of like a life-changing experience. Like, I have to say, like, I'd always been kind of into crime, and the Serial really got, I was obsessed, and I just got really into the case. And I had always been into criminal justice issues, and I had always been interested in wrongful conviction cases. But something about that case definitely, like, you know, kicked me in the gut. And then, you know, going down there and actually covering the hearing, and I didn't know anything really about the law. So I was very much like, I had never done this before. I'd never sat in a courtroom and written about legal proceedings before. And I was basically like in court all day, and I would go back to my hotel and would stay up pretty much like 2 writing these exhausting recaps because I didn't know very much about the law. And I really wanted to make sure I got everything as accurate as possible. I mean, I had my opinions for sure. I don't think you could miss them. But my thing with that as a journalist is always like, I'm going to give you all the information. And along the way, I'll probably tell you what I think about it. But at the end of the day, you can at least go back and look and say, well, I completely disagree with Amelia's assessment of this information, but she did give me sort of everything that happened. And I think for the most part, I think people would agree that that's what I did. That was my goal. I wanted to be able to be like, I need to be as detailed as possible, cut off the trolls at the pass, and like tell them absolutely every detail that happened. And then if they decide that my assessment of it was crap, well, that's fine. But at least I will have put out accurate information. So.
Now, just as a final wrap up on this like Serial stuff, I met you for the first time at Rabia Chaudhry's house.
Yes.
And all of those Adnan Syed people were all there. Was that not the weirdest thing?
I've been to a few of them, and it's so fascinating because you're like, yeah, you meet sort of people and you're like, ah, it's John Cryer. What's up? And then Susan's there and you're like, hi. And it's all these like disembodied voices coming together in a room and taking form. But everybody's so nice.
Justin
Brown.
Yeah,
I've become friends with Justin. Yeah. He's like the loveliest. Him and his wife, I adore them. And they've been, you know, super cool and nice to me whenever I go down to Baltimore for work and stuff. So yeah, it's been, I felt like I've met like a new crew of friends, like really, really, truly good people I've met through covering this case. Like some of the kindest, most good-hearted, ethical people I've ever met in my life, I've met through covering Adnan's case and the kind of connected network of people. It's been very gratifying.
And me. All the ethical
Rebecca
people.
Yes, and you. And here I am.
All right. So, Laura, it's been a couple weeks since we've been getting a chance to talk to you, and I just want to make sure, has your life been okay without the crime writers? Have you been holding up?
Well, I've been surviving this really weird winter we're having here, and I'm going to have to lay off the Amazon crime writers purchases for a while because my driveway right now is just like a luge because we've had rain and then it freezes. So the UPS man got stuck in my driveway yesterday.
What?
I know.
It's a very New Hampshire story, yes.
It is. And then just because I really missed crime, I tried to poison my husband this week. So
Okay. Stop right there.
Nice.
What
did you use?
What happened?
But he's a firefighter, so he saved himself.
No, he's still pretty down. So, well, Kevin and Rebecca and Toby are off gallivanting around on these nice trips. I was covering a school board meeting, and I didn't have time to make dinner.
So you want to poison yourself.
I know. So I just like ran to the local little specialty shop and picked up some pork thing that my husband could throw in the oven. Well, I don't know what was in that pork thing, but the poor guy got food poisoning. So.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So
how'd you cook the pork? Just how you like it.
Know.
Pink in the middle.
He's like, what did you do to me? I'm like, I don't know. You know, you better behave, though.
Exactly.
Wow.
Main dish of pork, side dish of trichinosis.
Yeah,
everyone
exactly.
loves that. Well, Kevin and I just came back from an amazing trip to Cancun, Mexico, where... the highlights for me included learning how to do tequila shots for real, not with a lime and salt, and also getting my feet eaten by a bunch of fish. That was fun in one of those weird pedicure tanks.
Yeah, you go to the airport and stick
your... Oh, you did it?
Yeah, you stick your feet in like this fish tank.
Real weird.
Oh, you did that.
Did
yeah,
it?
Yeah, she did that.
I have been interested in this. What does it feel like, Rebecca?
Me. Yeah, it feels like a bunch of fish eating your feet. But I have gotten a bunch of negative feedback about it on my Instagram account. People telling me that it's cruel to the fish, that it's unhygienic,
what?
That you could get all sorts of diseases. All I got to say is I put my feet in the water, not my intimates. And it was a nice way to pass time at the airport. And, you know, if you ever get the opportunity, I'm not going to tell you shouldn't try it because everyone should be able to tell that story at least once.
I thought we were in Mexico for almost a week, and that was definitely the cleanest water we saw.
Oh, yeah. Wait, did it make your feet? What did it make your feet all smooth? Did it actually work?
It was only in there for like 15 minutes, so I think it would have taken longer for my feet. I'm from New Hampshire, after all. I'm not exactly a pedicure every week. One other thing I wanted to talk about, listener feedback. We've gotten a ton of emails, and I think this is what we should talk about next episode, the new NPR collaborative podcast called Suspect Convictions.
Okay.
I hear that is the podcast that we should rate and review and recommend or not. So that's what we're going to be talking about next week. So listeners, you're not obligated to do this homework anymore, but if you want to, feel free. We're going to be talking about the NPR collaborative Suspect Convictions podcast next week.
Right now I'm downloading it.
I just started listening today, people.
Coincidence.
Oh, God, another one for me to get addicted to.
And you know what they did? I'm going to give you a heads up. They said, we're dropping our first episode on the 9th. They dropped 6 episodes at once, which I thought was kind of interesting.
It is interesting. There's another podcast I've been listening to, a really great podcast that's very divisive in our house, about Billy Joel, called We Didn't Start the Podcast. It's actually done by a friend of mine. It's very, very funny, especially if you're not like a huge Billy Joel fan. You'll absolutely love it because I think it's divisive because Kevin takes it very personally.
Oh, stop.
But they dropped all 13 of their episodes at once, which I found very interesting. And their episodes are full of fake ads about fake businesses on Long Island, which is also funny. So anyway, so next week, Suspect Convictions. There's a bunch of other reporting partners on it, but I'm just going to say it's an NPR collaborative podcast.
Cool.
So now it's time to move on to a little segment that we do where we talk about true crime and what has happened in those stories. What's that called, Kevin?
True Crime Podcast Update. Oh, this wasn't a podcast.
Wasn't a podcast.
Right.
Do it again.
True Crime Update.
All right. We'll add some echo to that. It'll be fancy. Burke Ramsey, the brother of JonBenet Ramsey, just after Christmas filed a lawsuit seeking $750 million against CBS Corp, saying the broadcast company produced a fraudulent documentary that slandered him by accusing him of killing his sister JonBenet Ramsey in 1996. Now, we talked about the earlier lawsuit for $50 million that Burke Ramsey had filed against Werner Spitz, one of the experts in the documentary. But this was a much more sweeping, much broader lawsuit. Among the claims, I have some highlights here. I won't read them all. Is that CBS portrayed this as being a special pact full of forensic experts who the lawsuit claims aren't really experts. They are media figures who took a point of view that already existed and turned it into a TV show, that they didn't really do a new investigation, and that they took this point of view that existed and was published in a previous book and fleshed it out for this TV show. So the lawsuit raises some really interesting questions. And Amelia, I want to start with you because you wrote a story for Rolling Stone back when the CBS special came out called three big ways the case of JonBenet Ramsey got it wrong. So I'm guessing you were not a fan of that special.
I hated it so much. I found it so, I mean, so just, I found it really upsetting. And I'm not somebody who was like a diehard follower of this particular case. So it's not like I came into it with like super strong feelings about who I thought killed JonBenet, although I feel like I've started to develop some sort of opinions on it. But what I found really upsetting was the way that they sort of determined that this child that killed his sister was based on like really nothing. A lot of really junky science, and then just a lot of making up stories in their head. Like the whole thing of them, you know, Burke killing JonBenet over the pineapple. Where did they get that idea? It's like they made it up. It was weird.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you talked about too, which is one of the things that I think we really kind of criticized on the show, was the confirmation bias and selective rehearing around those.
Good Lord. First of all, that the lawsuit's accurate. It's, I mean, one of the things I reported on my story is about the fact that, like, nothing in the special was actually new. Like, that audio, you know, the whole sort of performance of going to the audio studio and, like, taking out all the background noise and slowing it down, trying to figure out what was said, and then putting on the headphones, and the realization was, okay, what they said they heard had already been written about years ago, and they did nothing to the audio that hadn't already been done. I mean, it was literally a performance that they didn't acknowledge as being a sort of performance. That's ethically really shady.
Now,
you know,
one of the things I actually learned a lot reading the Denver Post's recap of the lawsuit. I haven't read, I'm sure it's a very long document, but I did read the Denver Post did some really good reporting on the lawsuit. And one of the things they said, which surprised me, Kevin, and I don't know if you'd heard this before, was that a bunch of tabloids had already speculated that Burke Ramsey was the killer. And he had successfully sued them and settled for monetary libel settlements against tabloids who the Globe, for example, the Star and Globe reported that after showing signs of disturbance, including that he smeared feces in his bathroom, the, quote, squirrely child killed his sister. The New York Post, he got a settlement from them for libel. So this wasn't the first time someone took a media bite at the apple on Burke Ramsey and ended up on the other side of a lawsuit. Is that something that you knew before?
I did not remember that. I think if I had done a deep investigation of Burke Ramsey,
by Googling him,
that would have come up. Yeah, I probably would have been terribly aware that. He can be litigious. But with a case like this that's so well known and people still, you know, are just fascinated by it, and when it's left open and you have someone who is a person of interest and there's a lot of circumstantial evidence against them, it's hard for, you know, the accusations to come and, you know, cross the line. Where that line is always sort of hard to find out, and you probably don't usually know it until you've already crossed it. But I was not in the production meeting at CBS, but I am sure there were a ton of lawyers there, and they thought, okay, this is as clean a version of this as we're going to get.
Right, right. Now, Laura, one of the things that really stuck out to me in the lawsuit was the lawsuit says that the series was fraudulent because it claimed it assembled seven independent, quote, world-renowned investigators to investigate the case from scratch, but the show was based
on
asked
the world and nobody knew him?
Well, no. The lawsuit says the show was based on a self-published book by one of the people that he's suing, District Attorney Investigator James Kolar, who this was his theory, apparently, this Burke Ramsey theory.
Okay. Yeah, he was one of the original investigators, I think.
That the other people on the show, Jim Clemente and Stanley Burke, that they had worked for the FBI Behavioral Unit, but they're now co-workers at a company called XG Productions, which consults on and produces fictional crime films and TV shows, including Criminal Minds, The Closer, and NCIS. And though Laura Richards is described as a criminal behavioral analyst trained at New Scotland Yard, she also works for XG Productions.
So what?
Well, I guess what this lawsuit is saying is that CBS represented these people as independent investigators, but they are entertainers.
I disagree.
You disagree. Tell me why.
Well, I disagree because, I mean, yes, now they're in that field, but these people were all trained in the criminal justice field. They all worked in that field before they broke out on their own and went into the consulting business. So, you know, yeah, that's what they're doing now, but it's not changing what their education and their background is and why they are qualified to talk about and investigate this case. So, you know, I can see it. Yeah. I mean, obviously, like you remember, this is when I freaked out and started screaming about the house because I did not really when they reconstructed the.
Would you like to remind our listeners what you're talking about?
This is the part, Rebecca. I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you serious? They are building a fucking house? Like, I'm sorry. And then when they went in and there was the pineapple and the milk on the table, they built a fucking house. Yes. This is when I swore and people were very happy that I swore. So I was not a huge fan, but you know, at the same time, they did bring in people that were names that are legitimately known for being involved in cases. And I mean, to some degree, you know, you could say the same thing about people like this that then go on to become expert witnesses in criminal cases. I mean, they're just using their expertise in a different venue.
Well, a lot of these people are experts in criminal cases. Werner Spitz has definitely been an expert in a number of kind of high profile cases. I don't know if he was an expert in the Michael, the one in from North Carolina, the staircase guy.
Peterson.
Oh, Michael Peterson.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Werner Spitz or it was the other forensic doctor guy who did the whole taser demonstration.
Yeah, well, Henry Lee was involved in that case as well.
Right,
yes. So they're legitimately like paid. I think they are the kind of experts that if you have the money to bring in your own independent experts and you're defending yourself in a trial, like they are the experts that are often called in. But I don't know, you know, how legit that science actually is. I think that's sometimes a little bit up for debate.
Now, Kevin, I do want to ask you one more question about this, because, you know, you have somebody like Henry Lee who has testified in a lot of real life trials and a lot of real life cases. And, you know, but now he has become a, you know, a celebrity. You have Laura Richards and Jim Clemente, both investigators who now have podcasts and they're producing TV shows and are sort of leveraging their expertise into entertainment. You have us. We're, you know, you can argue that we're doing the same thing. You sometimes appear on television shows. You get a dossier about a case and then you are the expert and you didn't actually investigate the case. I mean, it happens, right?
Sure.
But do you think that there is something where the public, the general public who doesn't see the inner machinations of these true crime media products, when they watch something like this, they do think they're watching a real investigation? Does the lawsuit have a point there?
Perhaps. Yeah. I mean, I think all this stuff about they were professionally trained, but now they're doing network television. That's very weak. Does the audience think that they're seeing? Yeah, I mean, I think they do think that they're seeing a real investigation. Mm-hmm. And I think Amelia pointed out sort of, you know, in her writing where that falls short. If Jim and Laura went into that recording studio already knowing what they're going to hear.
What they think they're going to hear.
What they think they're going to hear on the tape, and then they go through the, you know, the process. Then that's fakery. But if the rest of it is like, we have these theories and we're going to put it to the test, you know, using the set that we have, you know, the cobweb thing. All right. You know, I mean, it's
the big fucking fake house,
the big fucking fake house,
and the fake fucking pineapple.
Yeah. But I think that people watching are thinking that they're seeing a type of investigation.
I think that for me, the thing I actually found to be the most kind of disturbing, the thing that I think was most upsetting about it, it's less that I'm personally concerned about, like, Burke Ramsey. I'm sure he's, you know, doing as well as can possibly be done given his life.
Given how weird he is and that he's allegedly a killer.
Yeah.
Come on.
But I think that it contributes to this idea that they're, you know, that is already pervasive in the way we look at people in the aftermath of tragedy, that there is some way that is normal to behave and some way that's not normal to behave. You couple that with the fact that Burke was already clearly, a different child in some sort of way. And he's clearly a unique seeming kind of guy now. I don't know what that maybe means in terms of any sort of diagnosis or anything like that. But I think it's incredibly dangerous for those investigators, quote unquote, to watch a video of a child and then determine that he is behaving oddly in the aftermath of his sister dying, and thus that is evidence of him maybe being a killer. I mean, that's dangerous to other people because it shapes the way, it just contributes to the way we view criminals and the way we view how these crimes are committed. There isn't a a sort of longer effect that affects everybody, I think.
I completely agree with you. Just before, when I made that joke about him being weird, I was putting air quotes around it, which of course you can't see in a podcast.
Yeah.
So just to clarify that for our listeners, the other point the lawsuit makes, which we've talked about on the show many, many, many times, is that Burke Ramsey is a private citizen who has never been publicly named a suspect in the case, was living a relatively normal life, and did not ask to become the subject of this basically murder accusation. And that's where a lot of libel claims are successful, because he was not a person of interest. He was not named in press conferences by the police. Unlike other podcasts we talked about on the show, he was not a suspect. He was not questioned in the way that, you know, would make him open to this kind of reporting, again, air quotes, and have a weaker claim for the lawsuit.
Yeah, they don't have to prove malice.
Right.
Which would show that they knew or they had reason to believe that the information was false, and they went ahead and broadcast it anyway.
Now, one quick question. I don't want to get too deep into this, because we might talk about it in the future. Is a big trend right now of rehashing these old cases. We talked about that crazy-looking documentary that's coming out with Maybe O.J. is Innocent. But we have seen now a revival of the Menendez brothers.
Loved it.
Tell us. Quick thoughts, Amelia.
I think when that case actually occurred, I was just a little bit too young to
want to marry them like all the other.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't resonate with me. And then by the time it was going to trial, it was also during OJ time. And OJ was airing on TV at the time that my soap opera was supposed to be airing. So I watched all of the OJ trial. So I totally missed the Menendez brothers thing. So watching, and I was like, you know, vaguely aware of it, but watching the special that was on last week, I was blown away. I mean, the whole molestation thing, and then watching them testify, like, was that footage out at the time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I found it completely believable.
It was televised. I mean, they received marriage proposals. Then there was that amazing interview with Barbara Walters where they were saying, we're just, regular guys. And she's like, who killed their parents.
Yeah.
So that new Law and Order series that's coming out around that case, I'm planning on watching. It sounds like, Amelia, you're going to be enjoying that one as well.
Yes, for sure. I love that all these cases are being revived, though. There's a lot of really good cases that happened like 20, 25 years
ago. Pre-social media, sort of pre our ability to read about it on RollingStone.com 10 minutes after it happened.
Nobody's gotten to my dream case yet. That's my dream to read.
Which is?
Which one?
Well, nobody better steal this. This is my idea. Nobody take it.
All right.
The Darlie Rudier case. She's on death row in Texas for stabbing her two sons. I don't think she did it. Free Darlie.
I don't think it's okay. I'm sure people from that area are familiar with it, but I'm not familiar with that case.
Neither am I.
You would maybe recognize her. It was in the sort of the same time period as a lot of like the Susan Smith case.
Yeah.
It happened at a time where people in the media was really interested in sort of salacious tales of mothers killing their children.
Yeah, or I think about, you know, poor Lorena Bobbitt, who her entire story became about her cutting off her husband's penis. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Really, she was this victim of, you know, years and years and years of abuse, and she will always be associated as the person who cut off her husband's penis.
And then drove away with it and threw it out the window.
Yes,
of the car.
Which I know you think is a really good detail.
It's a hell of a detail.
It's kind of incredible. She's like, you're not getting this back.
All right.
But he did.
All right, so quick round the horn poll. You are a juror in the Burke Ramsey lawsuit, $750 million against CBS. Which way are you going to land? Laura, go with you. Amelia, then you, Kevin.
Oh, boy. I think he wins, but I don't think he's going to win for $750 million.
All right. What about you, Amelia?
I don't think he'll win for $750 million either, but I wish it could come straight out of Jim Clemente's pocket. Yeah, sorry, I do. I can't stand him.
All right. What about you, Kevin?
I think they'll settle before it goes to court, but if just knowing everything I know, if I were on that jury, I would probably side with Burke Ramsey.
All right.
But yeah, again, I don't know if I would give that whole amount of money, because I think I would probably, as they say, you know, give it a haircut, because there's nothing like a good shave and a haircut. And a good shave you can get is with Harry's.com. Harry's
nice.
Razors are so fantastic. They leave my skin so smooth.
Yeah, smooth as Burke Ramsey's when he filed that lawsuit.
As smooth. Oh, well, let's see. Let me just, I don't see that in my notes. You know, everyone thinks there's like a Harry's. There's no Harry, though.
No.
It's actually two guys, Jeff and Andy. No, I'm serious. These are the, you know, the disruptors. These are the guys who had the idea about...
Probably went to, like, Harvard Business School or something.
Yeah, they were getting sick and tired of getting ripped off about the price of razors.
Yeah, they were trying to go into CVS and having to wait for someone to open that stupid plastic thing so they get their stupid razors.
Yeah, so they started Harry's to fix that. They bought their own factory. And so by taking less of a profit selling directly over the internet, they're able to offer blades at half the price. So it's just about $2 a blade compared to the $4 you'll pay at the drugstore, minus the time off of work that you have to spend waiting for the clerk to come over with his giant key ring.
To open that stupid plastic thing.
Yeah, to open the stupid thing. Yeah, so why is Harry so great? Hey, 5 precision blades. If only Toby were here and he could talk a little more about how smooth his face is.
I'm here. I'm Italian. I shave my legs with a Harry's, and it's pretty damn great.
Did you?
Yeah.
I'm going to try that. I gave him up for Christmas this year, so I have made use of the Harry's.
Ladies, it's okay. You can use the Harry's razor. It's fantastic. Maybe they should go with a Harriet, because it's pretty friggin' great.
The Harriet.
Oh, that's a good idea. I like
genius.
It.
Yeah, yeah. You know how they give each of their packages different names? That could be the Tubman.
No, okay.
Harriet Tubman, right?
It has different imagery for me. But okay.
Is there another Harriet?
I don't know. Go with
Harriet the Spy. Ooh.
Harriet the Spy.
Yeah, okay.
No, when you're shaving your legs, the spy is not something you want jumping into your mind.
But Harry's
is so confident in the quality of their blades that you want to get your first shave set for free. That's right. You heard that right.
Free?
Just cover shipping and handling when you sign up. Plus, as a special offer to fans of our show, you go to harrys.com right now and enter code CRIME at checkout and get a post-shave bomb, also free. So you'll get the blades, the handle, and the rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover, which is good if you're going to be taking your Harry's
to the hospital when you get food poisoning?
No, to Cancun, so you look good. You look good for all the senoritas. So go right now to harrys.com. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com, code CRIME.
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 Crime. Anything else?
No, I mean, that's just what makes men look good.
What makes ladies look good.
I think it's new hair color from Madison Reed.
Yeah, I actually just got my Madison Reed box today. I'm super excited about that.
Yeah, I know. Here, what do you want? You want the script?
I'll take it.
I'm pulling it away from
I can talk about Madison Reed. I've used it. You haven't. You have your salt and pepper situation over there. Did you know, Kevin, that over 100 million women color their hair each year? 100 million.
I did not know that, no.
But that's not the most surprising part. The most surprising part is the basic chemistry of hair color has barely changed in the last 100 years.
Ugh.
That is until Madison Reed came along. If you haven't heard of Madison Reed, well, it's the future of hair color. It believes in a better way. Beautiful, natural, healthy-looking hair like mine. The hair color is made in Italy, just outside of Milan, according to strict EU standards that require complete transparency.
Now, a lot of the other hair colors have all these different chemicals and things like ammonia and
Parabens. Here, say that one.
Resorcinol.
Resorcinol, PPD, the kind of stuff
I didn't go to college for chemistry.
It's the kind of stuff that makes you not able to catch the fish because the fish are all full of that chemical and it makes you sick and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff's in hair color. But anyway, not in Madison Reed. So if you're looking for gorgeous hair color made with ingredients that have integrity, go to madison-reed.com. Take their hair color quiz. Find your perfect shade. You don't need an appointment with your lady that will take you 6 weeks to get. So if you're looking for gorgeous hair color made with integrity, go to madison-reed.com. Take their easy color quiz. Find your perfect shade. Get 10% off plus free shipping on your first kit using promo code WRITERS. That's madison-reed.com. Promo code WRITERS. Satisfaction Writers. Guaranteed, and your hair will look just like mine. No, not really. It looks like yours, but better. Madison-Reed.com.
No,
but I got to tell you, I really do like it. I do. I wouldn't say I did it if I didn't.
Well, your hair always looks good. Your hair is I wish my hair always looked good like that.
Laura, it's all I got, okay?
That's not all you got going for you.
Rebecca with the good hair.
Oh my God.
Right now she has a sweatshirt that says, I'm Becky with the good hair.
I do. I'm wearing it right now.
Wow.
I knew it. That's all I got, Laura.
I'm going to be tweeting.
You've got so many
shit.
Things. You've got the firefighter husband. You've got the farm sink. You've got the bucolic country lifestyle. Amelia's got the metropolitan Law and Order street
sounds.
I've got
the high rent.
Yes. All I've got is this hair. Damn it.
Wow.
Exactly.
I like it.
Thank you. Madison-Reed.com. Use the code WRITERS. Okay. Now, I want to move on to the reason we're all here. Except, of course, for Kevin, who is terrified. He'd rather be anywhere but here. We are now going to discuss the A&E series Scientology in the Aftermath. So should you watch it, listeners? We will let you know what we think. But first, a brief but important disclaimer.
The church challenges the credibility of the contributors appearing in this program and their statements. As of the airing of this episode, the church has not agreed to participate. Information the church provided about matters discussed in this series can be viewed at www.crimewriterson.com.
Because by the way, the Church of Scientology, as we have learned from watching this series, they'll come at you if you talk about them. So one of the reasons why Kevin wasn't so game to do so, but, you know, I think it's fine. Everything here is alleged, right? We all agree?
Yeah, allegedly.
Yeah.
But let's talk about this special. Now, for our listeners who don't know, Leah Remini, of course, was a huge TV star and a longtime, very vocal advocate and spokesperson for the Church of Scientology. She, along with other celebrities like Kirstie Alley and
John Travolta, Tom Cruise,
Dharma from Dharma and Greg,
Jenna Elfman,
Beck. Lots of good people, you guys.
Yeah, Giovanni Ribisi, Scientologist.
I guess Steve Miller. Remember those? They came out.
Isaac Hayes.
That's right, because that South Trek episode that he was not enjoying.
Elizabeth Whatever, who from Mad Men, who plays Peggy.
Moss. Elizabeth Moss is a Scientologist?
Yep.
What?
She grew up in the church.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, Leah Remini broke with the church in 2013. And so here we are. And if you're not familiar with Leah Remini, I just want to give you a tiny taste of who she is, what she sounds like. Here's a clip of a promo trailer from the series, Scientology, The Aftermath.
What's the Church of Scientology so afraid of? These are just some of the things the church said about me. A&E viewers should know a program about our religion hosted by Miss Remini is doomed to be a cheap reality TV show by a has-been actress now a decade removed from the peak of her career. Miss Remini has become what she once declared she never wanted to be known as, this bitter ex-Scientologist. She needs to move on with her life instead of pathetically exploiting her former religion, her former friends, and other celebrities for money. When you stop f***ing people's lives and families, I'll stop too.
Now, you have been covering Scientology, The Aftermath for Rolling Stone magazine. And Amelia, I have to say, your articles, Five Things We Learned About Scientology in this week's episode of Scientology, The Aftermath, not only are they excellent prep material for a podcast in which you're going to talk about the series, but you really do a good job covering the width and breadth of the details that come out. But let's talk about Leah Remini herself for a second.
Love her.
Is she the most unlikely or likely advocate to put something like this together? What do you think?
I think actually it's so interesting. You know, she has the kind of personality where I'm actually sort of surprised that she was brought into the fold kind of as much as she was, because she strikes me as being like very opinionated, very strong-headed, very strong-willed. And that kind of thing doesn't go over so well in a church where you're supposed to be essentially sort of super subservient to one person at this point. And, you know, she's the exact wrong person for them to have kind of pissed off. I love her. She's like, I'm going to leave and I'm going to take the whole church down with me. I love her.
Right.
Yeah.
But doesn't that also make her, Kevin, like a great person to have on your side? Because when you see those old clips of her talking to reporters about Scientology, she's using that same sort of no-nonsense, no-bullshit thing when she talks about the church, like, yeah, the world's a better place because the church is here. And if you don't think that, there's something wrong with you. Couldn't you see why they would want her on their side?
Yeah, you know, I actually think that what makes her powerful is that she has the access to the other people that she's profiled. Because instead of a lot of, I don't know how to describe, lower level, everyday Scientologists, you know, she's able to bring in people who were in the inner circle.
Mike Rinder is one of them. Yeah, he's the main one.
So that they could, you know, share their recollections and their alleged tales of what happened when they were...
It's so afraid.
When they were in Scientology. Now, if I were a Scientologist and left, no one would care.
Your family would care,
my
apparently.
My family would care, yes. Then if I tried to call up some of these other folks and say, would you come on my podcast, they probably wouldn't. But Leah Remini can get them. So she's, as a convener, she's great.
Now, Laura, she actually reminds me of you quite a bit in sort of an unexpected way.
You mean the nails?
No, not the nails and the Louboutin shoes. I love, one of my favorite things about the series is whenever she has to read a church statement about discrediting the episode that they're about to do, about what's wrong with the church puts out statements about everybody that she's profiling in the show and about her.
They're always the same,
like, puts
by
her glasses
the way.
On. Yeah.
They're always the same.
This is what the church has to say about so-and-so.
And Leah Remini sits there in her full hair, full makeup, and incredible, incredible Brooklyn, not new cool hipster Brooklyn, but old school Brooklyn nails, puts on her smart glasses and then reads the statement. And she just does not give a fuck about the whole thing. And Laura, you love fighting the man. So can you not relate to this?
Oh, no, I can relate to this because, you know, I went through my own fight the man with the Scientology people. So I appreciate that. And
can you give us a refresher on that story? It's been
a while
since
mean?
You told
me
the story.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I actually pulled it up. So this was a long, because I'm watching this, and now this show, we're seeing a lot of the high-level people leaving, and there's a lot more being said publicly. So this is back in 1998. I was a brand new reporter, and I was covering these little towns in New Hampshire, out in the county. That was like my first beat. So just out in the middle of nowhere. There was a retired investment banker named Robert Minton. And he had become very upset about this woman, Lisa McPherson, who we heard about in the show, mm-hmm. Who had been locked up and she died. And he was just like troubled by this. And he started helping people leave the church at that time. And so at that time, I think that, you know, to me, seeing the people leaving now, in 1998, people weren't leaving like they're leaving now.
They were 2 years into their billion-year contract, Laura. They couldn't leave.
They were. Oh, yeah. yes, and he told me, I haven't seen this in the show yet, but the whole basis, the background, you guys know about this, the whole basis of Scientology was that Xenu, the evil galactic overlord, did we talk about this at all, controlled 9 planets in this section of the galaxy 75 million years ago, and then he decided to do a little population control by wiping out 7 billion people.
Yeah.
And then Xenu injected the bad people with glycerol and alcohol, froze them, and sent them in rocket ships to T-Jac. T-G?
That's where they're from,
Yeah, the Scientologist name for Earth. Yeah, and then he deposited them in volcanoes. It's just crazy. So anyway, so this guy was out in Sandown, which is this very small town here in New Hampshire, at his summer home, hiding some of the people that had left the church, and the church kept coming out and protesting, and it was getting to be very confrontational. And so, you know, one night he went out in the middle of the night in his bathrobe and fired off a shotgun, which is very New Hampshire. and they filed charges against him. And so it just became this ongoing thing for about 6 months where I would get these phone calls like, the Scientologists are back again in Sandown. And I would go out there and they'd be like, we're protesting this man. He is evil. And, that was my little brush with Scientology. And then they did give me the CD of their brainwashing subliminal messaging music, alleged brainwashing music, which I burned.
Was your brain actually washed?
And they tried to get you to get into their car.
They did.
Right?
And I'm trying to remember. I think they were going, at one point I had gone to the police station because I heard they were coming out to protest. And they showed up in their car and they're like, do you want to ride? We're going to protest. We're the Scientologists. And I'm like, I don't think I got in the car. I can't remember if I got in the car with them. I may have gotten in the car with them.
Stranger danger.
Yeah. I hope you didn't tell your mom about that afterwards.
But I know
especially
this is when
Scientologists.
They did get, this is the day they gave me the CD. And they're like, here's a CD of our music.
One of the things that I have found really fascinating about this series is that whole story that Laura just told about the origin story of Scientology, mm-hmm. it's not focusing on that. And I think it's because you could tell that origin story about any number of religions and characterize and say it's, you know, crazy or whatever. It is instead focusing on the church as a scam and as a cult and as a, you know, divider of families. She talks about the tactics. The tactics seem to be a big focus in this series. And in terms of the religion stuff and the belief stuff and the way that they sort of get people to advance, it's very much like joining a corrupt karate school where you just pay and pay and pay and get more lessons. I loved the episode where she showed the bridge to total freedom and exposed it.
Oh my God, I want that as a poster for my wall so bad.
Yeah, Amelia, has that struck you, how much focus there's been on tactics and the scam and the monetary stuff and how much more credibility that gives sort of this side of the story?
I think it's actually really, really important. Well, first of all, the Xenu story has been on the internet now for a very, very long time. So I feel like everybody, it's kind of like the go-to joke when people want to make a joke about Scientology, they talk about Xenu. And it is a completely kooky, I mean, it's actually kind of a fantastic little like short story. But as a creation story for the basis of a religion, it's a little, but it's as, I suppose, maybe as kooky as any religion origin story. I think the thing that is often kind of ignored because people are so busy spending time sort of making fun of Scientologists, like, haha, how can you possibly believe that? Is it's missing the fact that it's a cult that uses genuinely like abusive tactics to indoctrinate people and then control them. And, you know, the Xenu thing is harmless compared to what they actually do to people who work for the church, especially. If you're a sort of public member who, you know, maybe you get kind of, you get manipulated, I suppose, into, you know, giving money to take more courses. But the people who really, really, you know, bear the brunt of the abusive tactics that the church, you know, uses are the people who work for them. And these are often people who have been in the church almost their whole lives, you know, who grew up in the church. They get pushed into working for the Sea Org. I think people need to remember, like, leaving the church is, it's not unlike leaving an abusive relationship in the sense that you are cut off from, you know, what they do is they cut you off from your friends and family. And so when you leave, you have no support system. And then on top of that, you have these people who, if you're working for the Sea Org, you're working like 100-hour weeks for like, you know, $10. Like legit, you get paid no money and you work all the time. So people who leave the Sea Org, some of them don't have bank accounts.
Or education. They never went to school.
Or educations. And then, you know, their resumes, when it's time to go out and get a job in the real world, it's like, what are they going to put? Like a bunch of church, like, work?
I've been wondering that.
They can't use references, you know?
Yeah, I've been wondering that about some of the folks we've seen on the show. Because, yeah, I mean, you see Mike Rinder, who was the former, like, head spokesperson and head, by the way, like, heavy of Scientology, mm-hmm. the enforcer. Mm-hmm. He's now out and is a very, very out. Word-facing, defiant spokesperson against Scientology. You have David Miscavige's dad.
Mm-hmm. Poor Ron.
That was interesting.
Who, by the way, learned about the corruptness of Scientology by Googling Scientology, which
that was crazy.
On one of those book reader things. What is it called? On a
Kindle. Using WhisperNet, apparently.
Yeah. So amazing.
Oh, my God.
Like, think about that. That's, like, crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you have legit people who you imagine maybe could have written a book or somehow were able to support themselves. All I keep thinking about are all the other people, a couple of whom we've seen interviewed on the show, like, how did they, were they able to pull their lives together, buy a house, and make a living after leaving this church?
I know that, I mean, I haven't talked about this yet on your show, but the way I kind of came into covering Scientology is over a decade now, I was the research editor on a book about Scientology written by Janet Reitman, who's a Rolling Stone contributing editor. So I worked for her for 10 months, kind of like organizing her files and transcribing all her interviews with people. It's a brilliant book. It's called Inside Scientology. Everybody should read it.
Yeah, and excerpts of it have been published in the magazine. Rolling Stone did some of the most groundbreaking reporting on Scientology among any publication, I think.
Yeah, and Janet spent like years kind of working on this book. And so one of the things I had to do was transcribe the interviews with a bunch of these ex-Scientologists. And a few of them have appeared on the show. But at the time that I was working on the book with her, like Mike Rinder was still in. He was like a completely different person at that point. You know, he was the muscle for the church. So it's funny to see him on the show now and see what a kind of pussycat he is. But it was interesting actually listening to these interviews that she had done, because there were people who would sort of talk about what their lives are like now out of the church. And, you know, there were people who were really high-ranking members who were doing really important work within the church, like executive-level work. It sounds like they were great at their jobs under a tremendous amount of pressure. And, you know, they walk out, and I remember one of them, I remember distinctly, he had been like an executive in the church, and he left and he was like working at the post office, like sorting mail, because that was the job he could get with his, just the resume he had. Because let's face it, you walk into a job interview and like you can be like, I was an executive for the Church of Scientology, and people are going to be like, And no, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think if there's one piece missing from the show, I think she's tried and she's told the story a few times. I want to know, and Laura, I don't know if you've wondered the same thing. Now, Leah Remini wasn't a celebrity when she went to the into the church. Her mother was a Scientologist.
Right.
But they are pretty good at attracting celebrities. I think they use this sort of cloak of good works. But how do regular people, what do they want out of it? Laura, do you have that same question that I do? Like, what is the attraction here?
I don't know. I think it's you know, people that maybe are missing something in their life, or they feel like they need some sort of structure that they don't have, or they buy into some of the marketing that the church does. I actually had lunch with a friend today, and she was talking, a friend of hers who was a journalist, you know, years ago, before all of this started to come out as much as it is now, went to go tour the church just to be like, oh, I'm a person off the street who's interested, and started asking questions and was like, so how much does it cost me to get to the going clear level? And the person just kept saying, it will cost you a Lexus.
Wow. Yeah.
And she's like, like a car? It will cost you a Lexus. So I don't know.
Just tell me they're talking about a car and she didn't have like a daughter named Alexis.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I have no idea. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's, you know, you hear about people getting sucked into these things. I had a cousin who got taken in by the Moonies once. Remember the Moonies?
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of hippie stories with Scientology. Like parents are hippies.
Yeah. Early on, it was very much like that. It attracted a lot of hippies.
Yeah, it was like that EST program, like this sort of enlightenment.
I think it was more fun back then, though. That's the thing. Well, like, L. Ron Hubbard had a ship, and, like, everybody wore, like, you know, he had his own, like, Commodore's messengers, and they got to wear, like, outfits. Like, it seemed at least a tiny bit more fun.
Right.
And, like, a little bit, you know, rebellious and, you know, I don't think it's ever been particularly cool. But, like, now it is, like, it is the religion for boring narcs who want to like turn in their friends for things.
That's what I want to ask you about, Kevin. I want to ask you about what we have seen and learned, not only in this show, but also in the HBO documentary Going Clear that we talked about a couple years ago. The difference between the L. Ron Hubbard regime and what we've seen happen with David Miscavige. Like, what do you see when you see this imagery, when you see this guy, when you hear him talk, and when you hear about the way people talk about him?
Let me put it in terms that I can relate to as a non-practicing Catholic and the church and how it is shaped by its leader and how I think a lot of people understand that the church under Pope Benedict is very different than it is under Pope Francis. A lot of people know who Pope Francis is, and he has been much more, for lack of a better term, sort of open and approachable, whereas Benedict seemed to be a little more reserved and more about sort of the mystery and the mysticism of the church and the very sort of old school, hardline, conservative Catholic. Pope Francis, who was a Jesuit, right? So he has this whole other sort of philosophy, and it has shaped the way that people view their church.
Mm-hmm.
So it does make one wonder, after the death of L. Ron Hubbard, what direction Scientology might have gone in with a different leader.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that, you know, there wouldn't still be, you know, the testing where you hold the
e-meter,
and then there would be this, you know, scale where you got to go up, and then
can you imagine someone making Leah Remini with those nails hold those cans for like 6 hours? Seriously.
And also, like, the exercises they have to do where they have to go, like, walk over to a wall and poke it, like, over and over again for five hours.
Or go to a camp and work. Leah Remini on The King of Queens making millions of dollars a year.
Right.
Everyone is going to their private island during the show break, and she's going to Clearwater, Florida to work, like, in a book factory.
Seriously, what's
It's crazy.
It? It's terrible.
I'm just still traumatized about the whole silent birth thing.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
The baby's drinking barley water. Yeah.
Katie Holmes had to have a silent birth. And then we hear about all these family control measures, of course, that people allege that the church.
Well, this is the thing about this show in particular. You're right. And they have stayed away from, you know, the origin story and sort of the catechism about what you can do and that. and instead focused on two things, which is the alleged pyramid scam setup of, if you want to advance to another degree, you do this, you do this test, you go up. Uh-oh, there was a problem with a text way back down at this lower level. You have to go and do it all over again, right, and keep paying money.
It's like corrupt karate school.
Right, and that's a red flag to a lot of people. And then it's also the allegations of abuse and other sorts
alleged
of...
Alleged abuse?
Alleged... It's an allegation, right?
Sorry, I'm just making
fun. I can't say
of
an allegation of alleged abuse. Yeah, it's all these stories that the suppressive people are saying about David Miscavige and about the way he's run the organization, where it is alleged that people cannot see other members of their family if they're no longer in the church, or they want to leave the church, or they don't believe in the church.
It's also alleged and that he beats the shit out of people.
Right. And the alleged treatment of people and families.
Right.
I think that that's what is the thing that draws the rest of us into looking at that.
Right.
I took comparative religion when I was in school. I'm interested, you know, somewhat in Buddhism and somewhat in Islam and somewhat in Mormonism. But I'm interested in this in a completely different way.
Because they have so much real estate? Is that why?
Because they have so much real estate.
They really do. Yeah. They have so much real estate.
I think it's similar. It's sort of similar to Mormonism, though, in the sense that, like, it's a religion that we've seen in our... relatively our lifetimes, it's being born,
right,
you know,
correct,
in a way that we don't have for Islam or for Christianity. So we can sort of look back at and see, like, wait, human being created this, like, came up with it in their head,
right?
Like, yeah, come on.
Well, like, and the first 300 years of Christianity are very different than the following,
right,
two
but,
millennia.
And yeah, we've seen Mormonism evolve so much in the last 40 years, you know, where they changed their origin story to now black people are okay. And, you know, there's back and forth.
You just got that from the musical. That's
no, it's actually true. No, I'm going to beep out his name. Our very good Mormon, ex-Mormon friend gave us a lot of intel in the Mormon church. And, you know, he watched it evolve from the inside. And Mormons are making decisions about whether or not to stay based on that evolution. And Scientologists allegedly are not allowed to make those same decisions. Now, Amelia, we've seen all of these disclaimers on the show. They have to post the church's responses. They have, and I think, a brilliant move, which makes the show so much better. Instead of posting the church's feelings about the particular people, Leah Remini reads them, which is just so great. Now, you also have on your stories about the series disclaimers from the church. And in a couple of the stories, it says, you know, our publication reached out to the church and they provide us with a statement. Have you had any experiences with the church since you began covering the series?
No, actually, I haven't. And I have to tell you, I have never had anything shady happen to me. And like I said, I've been writing about the church for a long time for other places. And like I said, for 10 months, I was working on this book. And during that time period, you know, they never tried anything with me. I've written about the church ever since. And I've never had anything sort of negative happen. I've heard of them being sort of harassing of certain journalists, you know, knock on wood, I don't suddenly get like somebody banging on my door and harassing me. But I sometimes really feel like when it comes to the harassment of certain people, especially journalists at this point, their bark is bigger than their bite, honestly.
Well, I would just want to ask you guys each a question and then have you just weigh in. What is the most shocking thing that you've seen on this series or heard about on this series, Scientology the Aftermath? And would you recommend our listeners watch the series if they have not yet so far? So, Laura, I'm going to start with you. Most shocking thing that you have heard or seen, and would you recommend the series to our listeners?
I don't know. There's so much that's shocking. It's hard to pick one thing. I think one thing that really disturbed me was the way that they take them out on that boat and basically hold them hostage while they're, you know, studying for the final level. But overall, for me, I think the thing that I guess is shocking to me is the fact that the church isn't, I don't want to say crumbling, but that more is not happening to it with all these high level people leaving the church, that this is not becoming a much smaller church than it started out as. I would definitely recommend watching it if you're interested, because it's one of those topics, you know, for me, I get sucked in. It's something that I would definitely recommend.
What about you, Amelia? Most shocking detail that you have learned about in this series? And would you recommend that our listeners take a watch of Scientology the Aftermath?
Oh, well, first of all, yes, I think people should watch it. I think it's fantastic. Like, I really think it does a really good job of conveying what Scientology is without getting too mired in the details, and also really kind of conveys why it's kind of compelling to people, like what sucks in people, and then also how just abusive it is inside. In terms of most shocking thing, you know, because I've covered the church for such a long time, I knew a lot of this stuff. I guess it's just been really kind of illuminating to see just how many people have left in recent years and are continuing to leave, and to have all sort of the same similar awful stories, that it's not just a handful of people who have had really abusive experiences, that it is like literally anybody who's worked for the church has had a really awful time.
Yeah, my favorite thing about watching the series is not the shocking bits, it's watching who is taking down the Church of Scientology. Leah Remini, an unlikely and compelling crusader, whether or not you think the church should be allowed to do what it's doing and we should mind our own business or not, she is an interesting person to be doing this fight and trying to take them down. And I do think, to Laura's point, there have been people on the show who've made the case that the church is not all that it looks like it is, with the amount of real estate especially that they own.
For
and
sure.
That perhaps membership is dwindling. It'll be very interesting to see what happens, especially after this series. But if our listeners, if you're interested in Scientology, if you've ever seen headlines in National Enquirer and just want to know a little bit more, interesting place to look, this series. What about you, Kevin?
You know, a lot of the really shocking things to me were actually things that I already knew about from the Going Clear documentary. Those things include the church's war with the IRS over its nonprofit status, which I think is really important. The life of L. Ron Hubbard and his journey from science fiction writer to religious figurehead. The thing that was really interesting to me that I didn't realize is exactly how much money the members of the church spend on their religious training, which is all of these books that they buy and the tapes. You know, when you say that, it's thousands and thousands of dollars. If they are a nonprofit, you know, there are still rules where you can't sit on, at the end of the year, too much money. So it has to go somewhere, and it's going into real estate that they don't really need. To just sort of establish a big footprint. So if the question is, do I recommend for our listeners to try Scientology The Aftermath, then I say, yes, I think you should definitely bite into this one and savor it. Just like you might savor a meal from HelloFresh.
Oh, is it weird that I didn't see that coming? I didn't see it coming.
You're so blind, Rebecca.
I'm not blind to your fear of Scientology. I see it all over your face.
You're not, but you are not blind to my enjoyment of a great meal.
You do
and
have good food.
The folks from HelloFresh really celebrate fresh ingredients and the magic of making food in the kitchen. It's great because with HelloFresh, pre-delivered to your door, you get a box that contains ready-to-make meal, all the ingredients that you need. Everything is pre-portioned. And what I also like about it is that we can get the kids to make this meal.
Oh, yeah. They can become our slaves. They can become our little Sea Org members in the kitchen, making our meals for us.
Everything is there. HelloFresh gives you different options for their customers, the classic box or the veggie box. And pretty soon coming the family box. So you can order 3 or 4 or 5 different meals every week for either 2 or 4 people. And they're creating new recipes all the time. Everything is there, the whole meal kit. And it makes cooking fun and easy. Now, Laura, just like the rest of us on the panel, you have tried the meals from HelloFresh.
I have. And you know what? The thing that was great about them was they come with these recipe cards that are very easy to follow. And I had my husband cook for me. Because I am usually the one cooking and I actually relinquished the kitchen. So we had a pork chop and it had, like, I think, some sort of a simple little pan sauce to go with it. But it was easy to make and it was tasty. And the thing is, it's like, now you don't have to worry about what are you going to cook. It was quick, it was easy, and it was something that anybody could do. So, you know, my husband, he did a good job.
Yeah, the meals are really designed to take, you know, fewer than 30 minutes to make. So you're not spending the whole time in the kitchen, even though it's a lovely experience. You feel like you're one of those cooks on television when you have everything separated out. Mm-hmm. It's all delivered to your doorstep in a special insulated box. And for listeners of Crime Writers On, you can get $35 off your first week of deliveries. Just visit HelloFresh. Fresh.com and enter Crime 35. That's your age, Rebecca.
God willing.
HelloFresh.com, Crime 35 at checkout.
That's the promo code, Crime 35.
Crime 35. I think I've said that several times now.
Now it's time to move on to my favorite part of this podcast, a little something I like to call the
Crime of the Week.
This is an homage to our own Toby Ball, who is not with us this week, because our crime of the week comes from near his hometown of Syracuse in Wayne County, otherwise known to our guest Amelia McDonald Perry as upstate New York.
Upstate. The place where all my married friends live and never invite me.
In upstate New York, where 2 weeks ago, a 43-year-old man did his part to support print journalism.
How?
Joseph Talbot of Newark, New York, not New Jersey, bought between 900 and 1,000 copies of his local newspaper over New Year's weekend, and at $1.25 a pop, it was no small purchase. But as it turns out, Mr. Talbot may have had an ulterior motive with that purchase. You see, he had been arrested for driving while intoxicated, after driving erratically, and after getting pulled over, failed multiple field sobriety tests. After being brought to a state police office, Talbot refused to give a breath sample and would not let troopers take his fingerprints or photo, saying he didn't want to end up in the local newspaper.
Oh, well, guess what?
He was then charged with second degree obstructing government administration in addition to the DWI charge. And the plot is even more thickened by some clues found on Mr. Talbot's LinkedIn page, perhaps. It turns out he's a VP of an insurance and banking company. So yes, maybe a DWI conviction could be better kept under the radar. According to Ron Holdraker, the editor and owner of the Times of Wayne County, Newark, New York store clerks say they saw Talbot buy hundreds of copies of the newspaper over the weekend. It's estimated he did the purchasing at 8 different locations. According to police, he's scheduled to appear in the town of Palmyra court on February 1st. So
like if that was the Twilight Zone episode, like he would go and he'd buy all the copies and he'd get the last one. The editor would say, we sold so many copies of this issue, we went to a second printing.
Exactly. A million more.
A million more.
So, panel, here's my question for you. Laura Bricker, do you think this purchase was, in fact, an attempt by Mr. Talbot to keep his arrest under wraps? Or do you think he could have had another reason to buy 1,000 copies of his local newspaper? What do you think?
I think he was still drunk when he went out to buy the paper.
Allegedly.
Allegedly drunk. It clearly was. I mean, unless he had a really big paper mache project that he was working on. I mean, that could be the only other thing. We are currently working on the volcano project in my house, so it does take a lot of newspaper.
What do you think, Amelia? Do you think that Mr. Talbot was just trying to keep journalism alive or trying to keep his arrest under wraps or what?
Well, wait, did the newspaper write an article about him being arrested, or is this like something that newspapers do? They like run the names of everybody who's arrested.
Police log, man. Oh, small town.
Oh yeah.
Oh, wait, New York City girl.
See, this is the thing. I'm like, oh my God, is this like a thing that happens? I had no idea. I mean, I know about police logs. I thought it was just like the best of. I didn't know it was everybody.
No. They run
See, this is why living in a small town is not a good idea. Maybe he had a bird and he was just stocking up on like lining for the birdcage. I don't know. No, it sounds like, I mean, you know what? Good for him. He was like, I don't want anybody to know, so I'll just buy all the newspapers.
What do you think, Kevin?
Well, it wasn't a well thought out plan because all the newspaper people I know are pretty curious. So if one guy goes and buys all of the newspapers, he's like, hey, I know what our story is for January 2nd.
Yeah.
Let's go find that guy and find out what the deal was.
I would say it also wasn't a well thought out plan because here we are. We have a whole lot more listeners than that.
What's his name again?
Joseph Talbot.
Vice President of Banking and where?
Of New York, not New Jersey. Sorry, Mr. Talbot, but the cat's out of the bag.
Don't drink
the
and drive.
Newspapers. It just makes me wonder how much China could he have been packing. But no, I do think he was trying to suppress his arrest, right?
How much China was he packing?
I think it's time to wrap it up on that note. Laura Bricker, if our listeners want to find you online, maybe see your column about health and fitness, for which you've been getting a tremendous amount of flack from the community of Exeter, New Hampshire, how can they find you?
It's at Laura Bricker, and I have one announcement.
Okay, we're ready.
We have a cat of the week this week.
Yes, cat of the week.
Cat of the week.
These people took some serious initiative. These are my local historical society ladies this week, Barbara and Laura. And they do a video every week, the History Minute. They didn't have a picture of the building that was being moved in town. So for me, they put in a picture of a cat from 1929 that was prominent in the town.
Oh my God. A prominent town cat?
A prominent cat. His name is Fiddykins Dudley.
Right now, our friend Amelia is sitting in her New York City apartment going, I would kill myself if I lived the lives that these people are living right now.
She's watching self-driving cars going by, dropping hipsters off on the corner.
Guys, I don't even leave. I never leave the house. This is the most exciting thing to happen to me all week.
What about you, Amelia? If our listeners want to follow you online, how can they find your writing? How can they find you on social media?
You want to read all of my N-theta, which is the Scientology word for, you know, it's writing that's a crime against Scientology. Anything that's a crime against Scientology. You can find me on Twitter at XOAmelia.
They can also find you at RollingStone.com, which, by the way, kudos to you. You're like
Thanks.
Rock and roll, like crime writer.
You know, it's funny. It was my first magazine job when I moved to New York after college. So it's nice to be home.
What about you, Kevin? If listeners want to find you online, how can they do so?
If people want to send me, tweet to me their ideas about Scientology, I'm at TobyBallNH.
And I guarantee that if you tweet about this episode, you will start seeing paid Scientology ads in your Twitter feed, because I know I have. God. If you want to send me a tweet or follow me on Instagram, you can find me at Reb Lavoie. You can see a video of those fish eating my feet. You can find the show on Twitter at Crime Writers On. Sign up for our newsletter and buy stuff using our Amazon link at our website, crimewriterson.com. There you'll also find the link to send us an email with your feedback and questions. Please review the show on iTunes. It keeps us on the charts. And before you close that podcast app, check out our sister show, These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order podcast. We've got a great episode dropping in a couple of days featuring one of our favorite fellow podcasters, Patrick Hines from the Theater People and the Broadway Backstory podcasts. It's one you will not want to miss. Our very handsome line producer is Henry Lavoie. Our theme music was performed by the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble and used with their permission. This show was recorded in Square Egg Studio at Partners in Crime Media, a.k.a. the closet in our basement, formerly known as Studio C. On behalf of all the crime writers and our special guest, Amelia McDonald Perry, thanks so much for listening. We will catch you later. It's funny how we hear like atmospheric New York noises in the background. We never get that.
I have a door actually that can open out onto the street if you want to get even more of that.
No, usually we just have like, you know, crickets chirping and turkeys running around.
If we're lucky, we may get like a siren or two. You never know. Maybe a street fight. Who knows?
In crime media.